everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally, 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, about news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on reforming Social Security right after this. You know, with an income of $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Well, that's if you're self-employed and paying that 15.3% that's advertised. Well, then shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of $50,000 a second time? But you know, the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. That totals $7,650. Then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. So that means that you paid 17% of the $7,650 twice, didn't you? Now, you know, that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300, $1,300 from everyone that pays that tax. Now, what would you think if Sears or Penny's or your credit card company charged you twice like Social Security and the IRS does? Well, now, isn't that just kind of special? For more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school in general. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home education. That's the school. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. You can do that right now before you forget. GeorgeGordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, we've been talking about reforming Social Security, and I would contend that reforming Social Security is like trying to reform a whore. All you're going to succeed in doing is wasting your time and annoying the whore, because nothing good's going to come out of it in the final analysis. And that's because Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. It is economically, it is mathematically unviable. It's like we're taking two beans out of a bottle and we're putting one bean back. We take two beans out and we put one bean back. We look at this problem and we say, well, ultimately this bottle is going to end up empty, depending upon how fast we take out beans and put beans back and how many beans are in the jar. But we can all see, we can all recognize that ultimately, whether it's 2 decades or 5 decades from now, this bottle's going to be empty. So somebody comes along and says, God, we're in a crisis. The bottle is emptying out, and it's not empty yet. We're able to continue on taking two beans out and putting one back. Take two beans out, put one back. In order for this thing to go on forever, we have to take out two beans and put two beans back. Take out two beans, put two beans back. Now, if we do that, it'll last forever. It gets even better. If we took two beans out and put three back, take two beans out and put three back, this thing is going to fill up and overflow. That's an even better solution. But Social Security, from its very inception, was a program in which you're going to take two beans out and put one back. There have been times when we raised the taxes and we put three beans in and took two out. Put three beans in and took two out. And then more and more people started taking beans out of the jar. And each and every time that somebody came along to take more beans out of the jar than were going in, it reached equilibrium and then it reversed back the other direction again. Let me give you an illustration. Back in the 1950s, when I started in the program, this is 1951, that's when I got my Social Security number, the total maximum income that would be taxed was $3,600, and the maximum tax was 2.25%. So you only had to pay in $81 a year. So you paid in $81. Now, the reason that Social Security was so popular is we're only paying a little bit in on the expectation that we're going to get a whole lot more than that back. We're going to put in two beans and we're going to get five back. That for every two beans we put in here, we're going to get more beans back than we're putting in. And that's a classic Ponzi. You see, in reality, if you're going to get more beans out than you put in, well, then where did those extra beans come from? This is not an investment program or a property right. This is a social welfare scheme. It isn't even insurance. It's called assurance, A-S-S-U-R-A-N-C-E. It's not insurance. Insurance has a property right connected with it. So in the last program, I brought up that subject of property, and the Supreme Court of Idaho told us that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property. So there's no property involved in income. There's no property involved in Social Security either. Now I'll read some cases to you as we progress along, and I'll show that to you. But the importance of this arithmetic is this. If in 1951 you had, something more than 16 people paying in for everybody drawn out, because in 1957 it reached 16-1. In 1945 it was 45 people paying in for everyone drawing out. So the expectation was is that there's going to be all these people paying in, and there's just this one guy drawing out, 45-1, then 40-1, 35-1, 30-1, 25-1, 20-1. Finally got down to 16-1, 1957. But watch this. Not only are there fewer and fewer people paying in compared to the number of people drawing out, but the tax inexorably kept going up. It went up from 2.25% in 1951 to 3% in 1954, then 3.375% in 1957, and then 4.5% in 1960, 4.7% in 62, 5.4% in 1963. You see what's happening here? So from 1951 to 1963, the tax doubled. Can you see that? Then in 1966, it goes up to 6%. Then in 1971, it goes up to 7.5%. And each year, they're adding a little bit more to it. Because you see, as the years were going by, 1951, 55, 60, 65, 70, 75, 80, there were more people being added to the rolls. More people drawing out. More beans coming out of the jar than were going in. So, to maintain the equilibrium, we had to keep raising the tax. So you have more and more people drawing out, so we have to raise the tax in order to get more and more money into the system. Well, you can see that if you have to double the amount of money that you're putting into the system, you have a classic Ponzi scheme. At some point in time, this thing has to reach equilibrium. If it isn't in equilibrium, then it's out of equilibrium, and if it's out of adjustment or out of balance, at some point in time, it flies apart. It fails. Now, if you're a mathematician and you take these models and you work with the numbers, you can project this out into the future. You know, well, if this continues on the way it's going, ultimately, here's going to be the result. And that's what I read to you last time. The Social Security system at some point in time is going to cease to exist simply because the number of people drawing out and the number of people paying in are going to be at such loggerheads, such odds with one another, that it'll be physically impossible to continue. just physically impossible. Now, I looked at that some 20 years ago, and I said, well, there's a point in time out here when this thing is going to become unviable. I don't know when that's going to be. So I opted out. Now, here we are in the year 2005, and the President of the United States, George Bush, says, this thing is in crisis, and we got to fix it. Now the question comes up, is it fixable? Is it even fixable? If it were fixable, I'd say, well, yeah, we could do this. But it has never been fixable. Never. The solution, short term, has always been raise the tax. Okay, if you continually raise the tax by percentage points, at some point in time, you're going to consume 100% of the entire gross domestic product of the nation. I would predict that long before you get to the point where you're paying in 100% of everything that you create and produce into the Social Security system, you're going to give up and quit on that program. I don't know if it's when they're taking half, because the total federal budget in 10 more years is going to be taking 55% of every tax dollar you pay to the feds will be going to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Well, then the next step will be 60%, 65%, 70%, 75%, 80%, 85%, 90%, 95%, 100%. I would predict that long before 100% of the federal budget is going for Social Security and Medicare, that it's going to collapse, that it's going to cease to exist. I don't know if it's when it reaches 55% or when it reaches 60% or 65 or 70 or 75 or 80. I'll guarantee you that when it reaches 101%, it's going to collapse. Isn't it? All right, so now if you can look ahead, and that's all business is about. You know, a businessman sits at his desk crunching numbers and he says, well, we got 30 employees and we're producing 20 beds a day, or 30 beds a day, one bed per employee per day, and we're selling 25 a day. Well, it doesn't take you very long to figure out that if this continues on, we're making 30, but we're only selling 25, the warehouse is going to fill up, and then there won't be room in the warehouse to store it. So now where are you going to put these finished beds? So as a manager, as a businessman, I have to say, well, either we have to increase sales, we got to start putting more beans into the jar, or else we got to cut back on production. Now, if we cut back on production and we cut back on sales, well, then we don't need 30 people. We only need 25. Can you follow that? If 30 employees turn out 30 units a day, that's one bed per person per day, well, then we're going to cut that back to 25 people producing 25 beds a day. And if we raise our sales to 35 beds a day, then we have to add some employees, don't we? We've got to add five. I mean, you know, this isn't rocket science. Well, now just take a look at these numbers then. When we're talking about Social Security and we look at the history of it, I'm just looking at 50 years, a little slice of Social Security. And in the year 2000, the tax rate was 15.3%. Now, it hit 15.3% in 1992. Now, it's producing a surplus at 15.3%. This is the self-employment rate now. It's a little bit higher than that for you guys that are working for wages, but in round numbers, it's 15%. And so, in 1992, it hit this maximum rate, and it's going to continue on until the year 2012. It's going to have a surplus going in there. Then from 2012 to 2018, it's going to hit equilibrium, and the amount of money that goes in and the amount of money going out is going to be the same. And in 2018, there's going to be less money coming in and more money going out. And they simply take a look at it and they say, well, when we had 47 million people drawing, 48, 49, 50, when you had 47 million people drawing out of it, you had 105 million people paying in. So then you just keep adding on how many people are drawing out and how many people are being added to the workforce. So in the last program, I showed you that over the next 20 years, you're going to double the number from 50 million people drawing out to 100 million. You're going to double it over the next 20 years. Okay? Well, then you have to double the workforce over the next 20 years to keep the tax at 15.3%. To keep the same number of beans going in and the same number of beans coming out, you got to double the workforce from 105 million to 210 million in the workforce over the next 20 years. So we take a look at our birth rate. We take a look at the number of people that are in school. We take a look at the number of people in the workforce and how many people are going into the workforce. And the answer is, over the next 20 years, the workforce is going to increase by about 15 million people, 15% in round numbers. We're going to have about 120 million in the workforce, and we're going to have 100 million people drawn out. Can you follow that? Very shortly after that 100 million, it'll go up to 105, then 110, then 115 million drawn out, 120 million drawn out. It's headed toward 1-to-1. In 1957, 16 people paying in, supporting one person drawing out. And somewhere out around 2030, it's going to be one person paying in and one person drawing out. Now they're telling us, well, the Democrats' solution seems to be, well, we'll just raise the tax. Okay, well, you're paying 15% now. How's it going to be when you're paying 30% of everything you create and produce into Social Security? How's it going to be when you're paying 60% of everything you create and produce into Social Security? How's that going to fly? How are you going to pay your rent? How are you going to pay your payroll, make your payments on your cars and things? Have you thought about that? That's why I said when I started, I said, you know, reforming Social Security is like reforming an old whore. It just isn't very likely that that's going to happen. Now you can alter it and change it, and that's what they've been doing. You know, from 15.3%, we could raise it to 16.3% and then 17% and 18% and 19%. That's what they did for many years here. 1951, 2.25%. 1954, 3%. 1957, 3.37%. 1959, 3.75%. 1960, 4.5%. 4.7%. 5.4%. 6.15%. 6.4%. You see, every year, two or three, they'd raise it up just a little bit more. Just a little bit more. They're not raising it in total dollars. They're raising it by percentage points. That's progressive. See, if you were paying $100 in tax and they raised it to $105, then $110, $115, $120, $125, that's arithmetic. But when you raise it by percentage numbers, it's geometric. Now, geometric progression is called the magic of compounding. Let me show you how that works. Just take this little scenario down and then go get your Texas Instrument calculator and watch this. Little boy goes into the farrier, that's a horseshoe or a blacksmith, and he's going to get his daddy's horse shoed, and it's $12. $12 to shoe the horse. You get four horseshoes and 32 nails plus labor equals $12. So the horseshoe man, the blacksmith, the farrier, he says to the kid, he says, run a special today, sonny. Running a special. I give you the horseshoes free. You get the horseshoes free of charge, no cost to you whatsoever, during this special. And then I'm going to sell you the nails. And the first nail is a penny. The second nail is 2 cents. The third nail is 4 cents. And we will double the price of the nails for each nail for 32 times. We'll start with a penny, and we'll double it 32 times. And then you can take the change and go buy ice cream with it. How do you like that, little boy? And the kid said, well, that's a great idea. I'll take you up on that. So the blacksmith starts off and he puts in the first nail for a penny. And the second nail for 2 pennies. And the third nail for 4 pennies. And the, you know, so on up. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. So when we do this 8 times... we got $1.28 for that 8th nail. That's $2.55 total so far. Now we go on to the second shoe, and we go from $1.28 to $2.56, $5.12, $10.24, $2,048, and 4,096 and so on up. Well, now, you know, it doesn't take you very long until you're way past that $12. And when you get through with the 32nd multiplication, it's going to be $40 million. From one penny to $40 million is the magic of compounding. And that's why Paul O'Neill, when he was talking to Tucker Carlson, said that the American worker would be so much better off if he took 12% of his of this 15%. Just take 12% of it. Hell, I'll do better than that. Take 5% of it. I'll give you those numbers here in a day or two, but just take 5% of it, and you take the amount of money, $7,600. Isn't that what you people are paying in? If you got a $50,000 a year income, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Take the $7,650 times 5%. The next year, take $7,650 and add to that times 5%. And then the next year, add $7,650 to that times 5%. And when, by the time you get through 40 or 45 years, you know, so assuming that you start work at age 60 or 22 and you work until you're 62, that'd be 40 years. You work 40 years and you use the magic of compounding and you're going to have $1 million in the bank. And that's just at 5% interest. Five crummy percentage points. I wouldn't get out of bed for 5%. But you know, people invest in the stock market and they think 5% is the greatest thing since sliced white bread. Now, these numbers, by the way, in case you're wondering where I got them, I got these right off of the Social Security webpage. If you'll just punch in Social Security on your website or their website, and then you can just go in here and you can get all these numbers right off of their own webpage. And I presume they're telling us the truth. In fact, I think they're lying to us. I think that they're trying to make the numbers look and sound better than they really are. Not a one of these people brings in the magic of compounding. I've never seen any website, I've never seen the President of the United States, any Democrats or any Republican senators or representatives, until Paul O'Neill was on Tucker Carlson the other day and he brought in the subject matter of geometric progression. Now, when you get through paying in the $7,650 a year for 40 years, let's just take $7,650 times 40 years, and that's $306,000. Now, you're going to pay in $306,000, and the most that you can get out of that thing now, and this is in the middle, this isn't the top, but $306,000, the most you can get is $150,000 out. So you're going to lose $150,000 on the transaction. Do you really need to put in $300,000 into a program that you're going to get less than $150,000 back on? Are you so incompetent? Are you so ignorant that you're unable to save just the $7,650 so that you got the full $306,000 in the bank? Now watch this. Take $306,000. And then the maximum that you could get out of that would be $1,200 a month right now. So let's just divide that by 1,200. That would be 255 months. Well, 255 divided by 12 is 21.25 years. Now take 62, 72, 82. You'd be able to draw $1,200 a month out of your $306,000, no interest whatsoever, for 21 years. Average lifespan is only 10 years after you retire, 13 if you retire at 62. Average lifespan in the United States is 75.5 years, 75 and a half years. This would carry you out from age 62 to 83, past average. And if you died before that, you'd have something to leave to your kids. Social Security, you get nothing back. Nothing, not a dime. In fact, they're not even going to pay you that long on average. They're only going to give you $150,000 back, so they're going to keep $150,000. You know, it costs money to administer this program. And it's been administered continually by raising the tax by percentage in geometric progression. So the tax doubled from 2.25% to 4.5% from 1951 to 1960. It doubled from 4.5% to 9%. And by 1981, it doubled from 9%, or it went from 9% to 15.3% from 1981 through the year 2000. Now, if you take the number 72 and divide it by the interest that you're paying, that'll tell you how many years it takes to double. That's the doubling factor. 5% interest doubles in less than 15 years. So at 5% interest for 15 years, whatever you put in there, in 15 years, is going to double in its value. If you put $1,000 in the bank at 5% interest, compounded annually, at the end of 15 years, you're going to have $2,000 in the bank. That's the way that game is played. Now, you don't have to be very smart, and the government, if George Bush really wanted to do something for people, then our national debt stands at around $8 trillion. At least that's the authorization, $7, $8 trillion. Now, at 5%, if you got, let's just take 7,000 times 0.05, that's $350 billion a year is what it's going to take to finance $7 trillion worth of debt, $350 billion. Now, if we took that national debt and instead of selling it to the foreigners all over the world, what if our government came along and said, okay, from now on, you're going to invest your money in U.S. Treasury, all you Social Security people, at 5% interest. And that's the way we're going to finance Social Security, is off of the interest from the national debt. Then the recipients from Social Security, whatever that debt is, would be getting that 5%. You know, that would be economically viable. You could do that. And you people would actually, at the end of your life, at your working career, not your life, but the end of your working career, could then retire on your nest egg that you had accumulated by geometric progression over those years. You could do that. And then you would have something left over when you died to leave as an inheritance to your children. With Social Security, they take the same amount of principal and leave you with nothing. They pay you back half or less of what you paid in and leave you absolutely nothing. And most people call it the third rail of politics. That just goes to show you that the electorate, that is the average Joe Sixpack on the street, cannot count. He cannot do the arithmetic. Nobody in his right mind would buy into Social Security if he could do the arithmetic. Guarantee you there's no businessman that would do that. Now maybe you got some dumb common laborer out here on a muckraking job that might do that. You know, Jesus said the poor you have with you always. I guess there's always going to be some dumb, ignorant, poor people that have to be guided and directed, have to have some kind of guardianship relationship to protect them and take care of them. We have people in mental hospitals, that have to be guided and cared for and taken care of. We have senile people and have to have a guardian. I don't deny that. But I think if you've got average intelligence, you don't have to be very smart to do this, just average. You can do the same arithmetic that I did. Go to the Social Security webpage and get your Texas Instrument calculator out and start punching in a few numbers. I mean, hell, even if you've been to public school, you can do the arithmetic on here. That's where I learned it, public school, for crying out loud. You don't have to be too smart, to get out of public school now, do you? They're graduating, what did they say, 2 or 3 million a year that are functionally illiterate. Now, last time I mentioned to you that Social Security was voluntary in nature. Do you remember that? Well, Larry Becraft, and you can go to Larry Becraft's number, just becraft.com or Larry Becraft. He's on the web. He's got a web page, and he publishes a lot of legal information on his on his webpage. He's a pretty good old boy. He likes to prove negatives. He likes to take people that say that there's no place in the IRS code that says that there's a that tells you what income is, and then he'll prove that that's not true, and he'll show you where that's at. Well, one day he sent me a brief here, and it's called A Comment Upon the Voluntary Nature of Social Security, so I thought I'd share that with you. So I'm going to do that right after this message. You're listening to The Law, or an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law, or an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. The sources of information that we use on this program are believed to be true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and often we endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we recommend or endorse will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or sectarian. They may be racial or ethnic partisans who do not endorse the opinions or the beliefs expressed here on the Law Hour and editorial review. So when I say, let me read this from Larry Beecraft, that does not mean that Larry Beecraft endorses my program or endorses me or anything else. He may or he may not. All right, with that little caveat, let me comment upon the voluntary nature of Social Security so that Larry doesn't sue me. Let me give him credit for the comments that are and the sources here in his brief. And I'll bet he has this printed or published on his website. I'll just bet you that it's up there. All right, here's the comments upon the voluntary nature of Social Security. You know, today, every day, Americans are constantly confronted with greater and more frequent requests from all too many sources that they provide to the inquiring parties their number of the beast. That's Larry Beecraft's words there. It says number of the beast, the Social Security number, SSN. The examples of this modern day phenomenon are numerous and known to all. Many states are now moving to ostensibly require the display of a Social Security number on a driver's license. Public school officials demand that school-age children obtain Social Security numbers before those children may be enrolled in any public school. Private parties of all kinds, from banks to employers, deem it essential that they obtain the Social Security number of everyone with whom they may conduct any business. Now, with all of these entities making these demands, surely the law must contain a requirement that everyone have the number of the beast, their Social Security number. Or is it possible that everybody simply acts like lemmings, dutifully following the herd instinct without any question, assuming that such requirements without any knowledge? More simply put, does the law demand that everybody apply for and obtain a Social Security number, or is such purported obligation nothing more than so much male bovine feces? BS. Well, the first inquiry regarding the legal duty to apply for and obtain a Social Security number must involve an examination of the U.S. Constitution and the powers granted therein to Congress. Congress can only possess powers which are contained expressly or by necessary implication within the text of the Constitution, particularly Article 1, Section 8. So being straightforward and to the point, the problem here for Social Security is that no particular clause in this or any other article of the Constitution is sufficient to sustain such power to compel a domestic American to participate in a compulsory retirement or benefits scheme. The power to this mandate participation in Social Security must therefore be one which is based upon an implied power. To determine if this power is one arising by implication, a study of various Supreme Court cases regarding the limits of congressional power is essential. The states are arguably the governmental entities which might possess this inherent municipal power to compel participation in a retirement scheme. But if the states might have this power, an issue which appears to have not have as yet been decided, Does Congress have a corresponding power? Or can Congress assume this inherent power of the state and then claim that it is its own? Well, examples of Supreme Court cases which place some real limits upon the powers of Congress are manifold. In the license tax cases, cited at 72 U.S. 462 in 1866, the Supreme Court held that Congress could not authorize the conduct of business within the states in order to tax that business. In United States v. DeWitt, cited at 76 U.S. 41 in 1870, the court held that a penal regulation and a tax could not be enforced in a state. In United States v. Fox, 94 U.S. 315, cited in 1877, the court held that the United States could not receive property by way of testamentary device contrary to state law. In United States v. Fox, 95 U.S. 670 in 1878, a penal statute remotely related to bankruptcy laws was held inapplicable in the states. In Patterson v. Kentucky, 97 U.S. 501 in 1879, the court held that U.S. patent laws conferred no superior rights within the states. In Hammer v. Dagenhart, 247 U.S. 251, the court held that congressional attempts to regulate and control manufacturing activities in the states was unconstitutional. Now, there are 24 of those cited here. I've cited about 6 or 8. 24 of those. So the Congress doesn't have any power to compel. And if they did have that power, you wouldn't have freedom, would you? You know, we Americans have always, you know, held out to everybody else in the world that we're free. We like to talk about our freedoms all the time. I had a Russian lady in here the other day. I said, well, how's the social security system work in Russia? And she says, we don't have any social security system in Russia. Well, Colin Powell made the same observation. Here's Colin Powell's words. Colin Powell said, finding the Russian scientists may be a problem, being that Russia does not have a social security system, as here in America, that allows us to monitor, track down, and capture an American citizen. So Colin Powell said, well, we don't have a social security system in Russia. They're not stealing 15% of the Russian people's money. I guess they steal it in other ways. This is Colin Powell, our Secretary of State. Finding the Russian scientists may be a problem, since Russia does not have a social security system, period, as they do here in America, that allows us to monitor, track down, and then capture an American citizen. That's the first three things they want. They want to know your name, birth date, and social security number to identify you. Now, when the government is identifying you, who's the master and who's the servant? Huh? You know, the United States government is the master, and the citizens of the United States are the servants of their master. So you can forget about this crap of sovereignty and sovereign citizens and sovereign individuals. That's poppycock. You know it, and so do I. So why say it? It's just nonsense. Now, there might have been a time in America when you had sovereignty, and there might have been a time in America when you had rights, but that's long gone. That's not here any longer. The genesis of Social Security is based upon the events of the Great Depression. While that era saw extraordinary unemployment and a tremendous decline in national production, still it was not as cataclysmic as other events in our nation's history, such as the Civil War. Further, no constitutional amendment was adopted during this era, which can offer any basis for an expansion of congressional powers. The legislation which started Social Security in 1935 must be viewed in the light of the various Supreme Court cases decided within a few decades of that legislation and prior thereto. When Congress adopted the Social Security Act in 1935, the Supreme Court had already held in Railroad Retirement Board, Supra, that Congress had no authority to establish a retirement scheme through its most tremendous power, and that is its control over interstate commerce. Additionally, the revolutionary acts of Congress adopted in the two preceding decades had been emasculated in a series of Supreme Court decisions. Are we to suppose that against this legal background, Congress decided to enact legislation of the caliber which had been struck as unconstitutional in the same year? In the Social Security Act, Congress imposed excise taxes upon employers, and those tax receipts were to be deposited with the Treasury. The Act further provided schemes whereby participants could enjoy unemployment and retirement benefits. When the Act was adopted, parties opposed thereto made challenges to the Act, relying upon some, if not all, of the various cases cited above. The major arguments mounted against the Act were premised upon invasion of states' rights. Now, in Stewart Machine Company versus Davis, cited at 301 U.S. 548, an employer challenged the unemployment tax imposed upon it, and the court held that such tax was an excise which Congress could impose. In reference to the contention that the subject matter of the Act was properly within the historical field reserved to the states, the court held that the Congress could enact legislation to aid the states in an area of great concern. So the Social Security tax is an excise tax that is imposed upon employers. And they can do that, just like the income tax. It's an excise tax. An excise tax is a privilege tax. And the way you as an individual become a member of this corporate capacity in covered employment is when you get a Social Security number and go to work for the machine shop, which is a corporation, or it has a business license and is acting in interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause, therefore it's regulated and controlled. The two of you are now in covered employment. Now, I'm a teacher. The Gordon Law School is a private school. The law school does not have a federal tax ID number, and George Gordon doesn't have a Social Security number. I'm a teacher in the Gordon Law School, and this is not covered employment. Now, if I went to work for the University of Missouri Law School, and I took a position there, the University of Missouri has a federal tax ID number, and I can't work there without a Social Security number. So I have to go down and get a Social Security number to get a job, and now I'm in covered employment as a law school professor at the University of Missouri. That's called covered employment. Covered employment is simply, does the business act in a corporate capacity, and are the employees covered with a Social Security number? If they are, it's covered employment. So you can be a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician. You can do all kinds of things out there in non-covered employment, but you have to do it as a matter of property and property rights as an individual, not in corporate capacity under a franchise issued by the government. Again, Wickard versus Filburn comes into play. It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Get out from under the subsidy. Beecraft goes on and he says, the court placed considerable emphasis upon the fact that the states were reluctant to adopt unemployment acts because such taxes created differentials between states which had such legislation and those which did not. And by creating a National Unemployment Act, this difference was eliminated and a great benefit to the American people resulted. The court, therefore, found nothing constitutionally objectionable to the act in Halvering v. Davis, 301 U.S. 619, The same rationale was used to uphold the retirement features of the Act. The importance of these two cases upholding the Social Security Act concerns the issues which these cases raised. Neither of them addressed the issue of whether there was a requirement for any American to join Social Security. The reason that this issue was not raised is because there is no such requirement, unless, of course, you work for a state government which has contracted into Social Security. And you can see that in public agencies opposed to Social Security entrapment. Versus Heckler, 613 Federal Supplement, 558. That case also went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'll cite that case and some relevant points in a future program. Now, the above review should readily demonstrate that there is indeed a real question concerning the point of whether one must submit an application to join Social Security. The cases which challenged the constitutionality of Social Security simply did not raise this issue of mandatory involvement in the Act, and it appears that no cases have as yet dealt with that question. The reason for this absence of a challenge to such alleged requirement can only be explained by analyzing the Act itself to determine if there is such a requirement, because Congress lacks the constitutional authority to compel membership in Social Security. The Act simply imposes no such requirement. Now, the Social Security Act, the Modern Day Act, is codified at 42 U.S.C. Section 301 through 433. If there were a requirement that every American join the Social Security scheme, then you would expect to find language in the Act similar to the following. It should say, it doesn't, but it should say, every American of the age of 18 years or older shall submit an application with the Social Security Administration and shall provide thereon the information required by regulations prescribed by the Secretary. Every member of Social Security shall pay the taxes imposed herein, and records of such payments shall be kept by the Secretary for determining the amount of benefits to which such member is entitled hereunder. Now, amazingly, no such or similar language appears within the Act. Now, remember, you can go read it for yourself. 42 U.S.C. Section 301 through 433. There's nothing in that Act or that section that requires you to join Social Security. I showed you that last program. From Social Security's letters themselves, they tell you, well, it's voluntary. You don't have to participate. And particularly, there is no section thereof which could remotely be considered as a mandate that anyone join Social Security. The closest section of the Act which might relate to this point is the requirement that one seeking benefits under the Act must apply for the same. But this relates to an entirely different point than a requirement that you join. So if in Bowen versus Roy, question came up, can you get the benefits without the number? And the court said no. Well, I don't want the benefits and I don't want to pay the tax. So if I don't want to participate, I don't have to. So you can opt out. It's not easy, and you need to know how to do that. That's why we teach a law school here. I mean, once you've joined, it's like joining the Army. It's not impossible to get out of the Army before your enlistment is up, but it's tough. It's difficult. It's hard. It isn't easy. Now, you can get out of Social Security, but it's tough. It's difficult. It isn't easy. It's easier to stay out of the Army than it is to get out of the Army, and it's easier to stay out of Social Security than it is to get out of Social Security, but it's not impossible. But you got to know how to do it. So tuck that one away in your heart and don't run off out here and decide, well, I'll just drop out of Social Security by writing a letter and putting a postage stamp on the envelope, because that isn't gonna solve your problem. Furthermore, most of you do not want to drop out of Social Security without making sure that you can make a living without it. Quite frankly, in America today, you cannot live without a Social Security number unless you know how. If you just dropped in on the scene and you want to live in the United States without a social security number, I cannot imagine how you're going to succeed at that goal. That's beyond me. Now, I don't have a social security number, and I can live here quite nicely without one, and so can you. With some training and with some preparation and planning, you can do that. But if you're just going to drop your mark of the beast tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, you're not going to be able to work. You're not going to be able to pay your rent. You won't be able to borrow money or conduct a business. I mean, you're going to be out here in left field. You won't even be able to get the telephone turned on, for crying out loud. So if you want to get telephone service and power and utilities without a social security number, then don't you think you better learn how first? I mean, it's not impossible, but, you know, it takes a little doing. It takes a little knowledge. Since the statutory scheme fails to impose any such requirement, the next question to be asked is whether perhaps the Social Security regulations themselves might impose such a duty. But here again, the regulations are no broader than the Act itself, and the duty to apply for and obtain a Social Security card or number boils down to the following, found at 20 CFR section 422.103. Here's what it says. Here's your regulation. Applying for a number, number one, form SS5, an individual needing a Social Security number may apply for one by filing a signed form SS5 application for a Social Security card at any Social Security office and submitting the required evidence. Two, birth registration document. The Social Security Administration, the SSA, may enter into an agreement with officials of a state to establish as part of the official birth registration process a procedure to assist SSA in assigning Social Security numbers to newborn children. Where an agreement is in effect, a parent as part of the official birth registration process need not complete a form SS5 and may request that SSA assign a Social Security number to the newborn child. See how numbers are assigned. 1. Request on form SS5. If the applicant has completed a form SS5, the Social Security office that receives the completed form SS5 will require the applicant to furnish documentary evidence. After review of the documentary evidence, the completed form SS5 is forwarded to SSA's central office. If the electronic screening or other investigation does not disclose a previously assigned number, SSA's central office assigns a number and issues a Social Security numbered card. Request on birth registration document where a parent has requested a Social Security number for a newborn child as part of an official birth registration process described in paragraph B2 of this section, the State Vital Statistics Office will electronically transmit that request to the SSA central office using the information SSA will assign a number to the child and send the Social Security number card to the child at the mother's address. The purported duty to apply for and obtain a Social Security number, therefore, boils down to this. You get it if you need it or if you request it. There's no legal compulsion to do so. So with the act of applying for and obtaining an SSN being entirely voluntary, the next question to be asked is whether any state can force you to use this number, which is voluntary in the first place. This appears to have been addressed by Section 7 of the Privacy Act of 1974, cited at 88 Statute 1896, which reads as follows. Section 7. A1. It shall be unlawful for any federal, state, or local government agency to deny to any individual any right, benefit, or privilege provided by law because of such individual's refusal to disclose his Social Security account number. 2. The provisions of paragraph 1 of this subsection shall not apply with respect to A. any disclosure which is required by federal statute, or B. the disclosure of a Social Security number for any federal, state, or local agency maintaining a system of records in existence and operating before January 1, 1975. If such disclosure was required under statute or regulation adopted prior to such date to verify the identity of an individual. B. any federal, state, or local government agency which requests an individual to disclose his social security account number shall inform that individual whether that disclosure is mandatory or voluntary, by what statutory or other authority such number is solicited, and what uses will be made of it. You see that in United States versus $200,000 in U.S. currency, cited at 590 Federal Supplement 866. Now, thus it seems perfectly logical, if having a social security number is not mandatory but purely voluntary, no state can use the lack of a number in any adverse way against anyone. The state cannot make that which is voluntary under federal law something which is mandatory under state law. What should the American people do who are opposed to social security for whatever reason? Be in the contention that it is the prelude to the beast number or any other. They should consistently inform those requesting the number that there is no obligation to have one. Here are some questions. Is Social Security mandatory? No. Is school enrollment dependent upon a Social Security number? No. Is employment dependent upon a Social Security number? Yes, if it's covered employment. Is Social Security voluntary? Yes. Is Social Security the mark of the beast? Yes. Can government require anyone to obtain a Social Security number? Yes. Does government require anyone to obtain a Social Security number? No. When do you need a Social Security number? Whenever you want employment benefits. Can you be refused employment because of no Social Security number? Yes. Can anyone be denied benefits without a Social Security number? Yes. And that's just where life is. Now, some cases have been tested where people who had a Social Security number refused to give a Social Security number, like U.S. v. Miller in California. He was a lawyer testing the issue, went into the DMV in California and said, "Give me a driver's license." They said, "Give us a Social Security number." He said, "No." Argued it to the Supreme Court, and they said, "Well, if you don't give them your number, you won't get a license." Let's try it on a different way. Let's have somebody go in without a Social Security number and have them demand one. Then you tell them, "I don't have one, and it's voluntary. Can the state of California compel you to get a number from Social Security in order to get a driver's license?" Now, that question hasn't been tested. I don't think so. All right, that's the story from Larry B. Craft on the voluntary nature of Social Security with the cases and the statutes that tell you where it's at. You know, Americans are constantly confronted with greater and more frequent requests from all too many sources that they provide to the inquiring parties their number of the beast, the Social Security number. So just keep in mind now that if you don't have the number, then you should write none, N-O-N-E. None. I don't have one. Then we can go from there. If you have a number, if you have a Social Security number, and it's being requested and you refuse to give it, now that's a little different story, particularly if it's driver's license in California. Keep in mind now that there's only 13 states that require Social Security numbers. At one time it was in the majority, but they have been taking that rule out. Here in Missouri, if you don't have a Social Security number, you simply tell them none, and then sign an affidavit to that effect, and then that's the end of it. And they'll issue you a driver's license with a different number on it, so they don't have to use Social Security. I'm about out of time again, and so I'm going to have to leave it right here, and we'll take this up again next time. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. the law. Our website is updated weekly and has our radio logs and schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet. Time's up. I gotta go. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.